The Infrastructure and Tourism Appropriations Subcommittee will come to order. Will DJ please call the roll?
Chair Andrade.
Here.
Vice Chair Cheney.
Here.
Ranking Member Silvers. Representatives Antone.
Here.
Burfield.
Here.
Brackett.
Here.
Daly.
Here.
Esposito. Gia Lombardo.
Here.
Harris.
Here.
Lamarca.
Here.
Lopez. Placencia.
Here.
Robinson.
Here.
And Yeager is excused. Chair, we have a quorum.
Thank you very much, DJ. Good morning, members. Today we'll be hearing 8 bills. I realize a few members may need to come and go to different meetings, so we'll work through the agenda as efficiently as possible. Let's go right ahead and jump in. We will begin with Representative Will Robinson to present House Bill 1341. Representative Robinson, you're recognized.
Thank you, Chair members. This bill designates the Army Specialist Nicholas Panepinto Memorial Highway in Manatee County. Under the bill, the DOT must erect suitable markers for the designation. The Manatee Board of County Commissioners sent a letter of support for this designation. Your staff report provides this bill will have insignificant fiscal impact to the State Transportation Trust Fund. The cost can be absorbed within DOT's existing resources. That is the bill, Mr. Chair.
Thank you very much, Representative. Members, are there questions of the bill? Seeing no questions, is there public testimony? No public testimony. Is there debate on the bill? Seeing no debate, Representative Robinson, you are recognized to close.
Wave close, Mr. Chair.
All right. Please call the vote.
Chair Andrade.
Yes.
Vice Chair Cheney.
Yes.
Ranking Member Silvers. Representatives Antone.
Yes.
Burfield.
Yes.
Brackett.
Yes.
Daly.
Yes.
Esposito. Gia Lombardo.
Yes.
Harris.
Yes.
Lamarca. Lopez. Placencia.
Yes.
Robinson.
Yes.
That's 10 yeas, 0 nays.
Thank you very much. Show the bill reported favorably.
Thank you all.
Congratulations, Representative. Next up, we will have House Bill 91 by Representative Clemens. Representative, you are recognized.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, Vice Chairman, Ranking Member. I know it's early in the morning, but I want to remind you all that it is 5 o'clock somewhere. Mr. Chairman, HB 91 is a Jimmy Buffett Memorial Highway designation, and thank you for allowing me to present this morning. If this bill passes, it will designate the historical coastal highway A1A from mile marker 1 in Key West all the way to Fernandina Beach, about 331 miles, something like that. Jimmy Buffett had a major impact on Florida, and it really can't be overstated. This bill would honor Jimmy Buffett, not just as a singer, but as a poet and a writer and an environmentalist and a businessman. And his passing last September 1st was a loss that was felt by so many people all over the globe, including me. You know, I never met Jimmy Buffett. I had a friend call me when they saw that I was going to sponsor this bill, said, "How many Jimmy Buffett concerts did you go to?" And I'm like, "None. Why does that matter?" But I really wore out 2 8-track tapes and 4 cassettes. That's how long I've been listening to Jimmy Buffett. But the pain of the loss that I felt and maybe that you felt paled in comparison by the loss that his loved ones felt. And I know there are members of this committee that were present when his daughter and his sister and his niece were present at the first presentation. Like many of our friends who've migrated here, Jimmy Buffett heard the siren song of the Sunshine State 50 years ago. He went from busking on the streets of Key West for nickels and dimes and quarters to being the architect of a multi-billion dollar enterprise, global. Florida's not short on amazing individuals. Jimmy Buffett was one of those. And without further ado, that is the bill. I could go on forever, but I won't. Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Are there any questions?
Thank you very much, Representative. Members, are there any questions? Representative Daly, you're recognized.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just briefly, Representative, what's an 8-track tape?
Representative Clemens, you are recognized.
By way of answering that through the chair, Representative Daly, There was a song in the past that said we read it in the want ads, and I'm in higher education, and this is no joke, that one of the students, young students that were 18, and they said, they asked the professor, "Professor, what is a want ad?" And he said it was something in a newspaper, and she said, "What's a newspaper?" Not kidding. So, listen, eight tracks were the very cool. You slicked them in, and you know what, Representative Daly, I know you may not be old enough, but when the tape came out, you took the pencil and you put it in there and reeled it back in, because that thing cost like $1.98 or something at the store. So, any other questions, Mr. Chairman?
Any other questions, members? Seeing none, there are no amendments. There is two public testimony forms. First up is Jeff Sharkey on behalf of Margaritaville Holdings.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Vice Chairman Jeff Sharkey. I want to thank Representative Clemens and Representative Cheney for their outstanding support and tribute to Jimmy Buffett. I represent Margaritaville, but Jimmy Buffett was a friend of mine for 30 years. I worked very closely with him on a variety of things. And as the representative mentioned, the family was up here last week. They just asked me to continue to tell sponsors and the members here how appreciative they are of this tribute, how important it is to them and their family. They said this is the most amazing thing that's happened since his passing. So again, thank you so much for your support and caring. And I think for a lot of us, every day is Jimmy Buffett Day in the Capitol. So again, thank you so much. Thank you, sir.
Thank you very much, Mr. Sharkey. Next up, we have Dan Hendrickson on behalf of Save the Manatee Club. Mr. Hendrickson does not appear to be here. He waves in support. Seeing no further public testimony, members, is there debate? Seeing no debate, Representative Clemens, you are recognized to close.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Brief close. Everyone was Jimmy Buffett's friend. Jimmy Buffett lived his life like the songs he sang. Someone coined the phrase that it was some sort of tropical escapism, and that was a word master that put that together. So true. Paradise was everywhere that Jimmy Buffett was. And my close is not nearly as good as Representative Harris's testimony in the last committee. So I will yield the balance of my time to Representative Harris.
Thank you so much. What I said was that when I first moved to Florida, I really had a tough time. I missed back home and I missed all my friends, but Jimmy Buffett helped me fall in love with Florida. I saw Florida through his eyes, and he had a way of making everybody fall in love with Florida.
Thank you very much.
That's my close, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you very much.
I ask for your favorable support.
Representative Clemens and Harris having closed. DJ, please call the vote.
Chair Andrade?
Yes.
Vice Chair Cheney?
Yes.
Ranking Member Silvers? Representatives Antone?
Yes.
Burfield?
Yes.
Brackett?
Yes.
Daly?
Yes.
Esposito? Gia Lombardo?
Yes.
Harris?
Yes.
Lamarca? Lopez?
Yes.
Plasencia?
Yes.
Robinson?
Yes.
And that's 10 yeas, 0 nays.
Thank you very much, DJ. Show the bill reported favorably. Congratulations.
Thank you.
Next up, we will have Representative Roach to present House Bill CS for HB 389. Representative, you are recognized.
Good morning, Chair Andrade, and thank you for agendaing this bill. House Bill, members, CS for House Bill 389 seeks to name a designated portion of I-75 between US 17 and Duncan Road as the Deputy Christopher Taylor Highway. Deputy Taylor was 23 when he joined the Charlotte County Sheriff's Office and was officially sworn in 2022, had his badge pinned on by his fiance, and was known throughout the agency for his love for fishing, his smile, and positive attitude. He was conducting a traffic stop in Punta Gorda on November 22nd, 2022, Just 3 days after his 23rd birthday and just 2 days before Thanksgiving, his vehicle was hit by a drunk driver at a high rate of speed, which in turn, the vehicle struck him and killed him. So we would like to ask you to honor the memory of Christopher Taylor by approving this highway designation. That is the bill, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you very much. Members, are there questions of the bill? Seeing no questions, is there public testimony? Seeing no public testimony, is there debate on the bill? Seeing no debate, Representative Roach, you are recognized to close.
Thank you, members.
All right, DJ, please call the vote.
Chair Andrade?
Yes.
Vice Chair Cheney?
Yes.
Ranking Member Silvers? Representatives Antone?
Yes.
Burfield?
Yes.
Brackett?
Yes.
Daly?
Yes.
Esposito? Gia Lombardo?
Yes.
Harris?
Yes.
Lamarca? Lopez?
Yes.
Plasencia?
Yes.
Robinson?
Yes.
10 yeas, 0 nays.
Show the bill reported favorably. Congratulations. Next up, we have HB 7049 by Representative McFarland. Representative, you are recognized.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. This is a PCB that came out of the Transportation and Modal Subcommittee. I know I've got several of my members here, so I won't belabor the point of what this bill does, but it's an awesome bill. That's the result of 18 months of interviews and research and planning, and it'll make significant changes to the way our transportation bureaucracy of planning, accountability, and oversight operates. So here's what the bill does. We're going to update our legislative intent for MPOs, Metropolitan Planning Organizations, charge them to focus on multimodal transportation systems instead of just surface transportation, and then to, as they serve the mobility needs of people and freight, also balance conservation of natural resources. It also creates a moratorium on the formation of new MPOs that are adjacent to an existing one. We're going to create a system of MPO accountability, whereas today their long-range training plans are produced and then submitted, and then they sit and gather dust, and they're checked for completion but not for quality. So we're going to have them be checked for quality. And if they're of poor quality, they're to be returned back to the MPO for a redo. Requires DOT to create quality performance metrics. Again, we have a lot of metrics today in the transportation world that are very good at measuring for like accuracy and completion and financial soundness, but not necessarily quality. I give a comparison to health versus wellness a lot. We have a lot of indicators of health in our transportation system, like the patient doesn't have a fever, the blood pressure is okay, but wellness is not so great. The patient feels crappy and has a hard time sleeping, or there's a four-lane road that stops at a county line and turns into a bike lane. Once we establish those performance metrics, every 3 years, if the MPO has a failing grade, they will temporarily be placed under the control of a person designated by the Secretary of Department of Transportation for a period not to exceed 1 year until that person get the MPO back on track. For a carrot, the top performing MPO, and this is relevant to you as an appropriations subcommittee, the top performing MPO gets $5 million to do whatever they want with. The bill also repeals the Metropolitan Planning Organization Advisory Council, MPOAC, but retains what's good about them, which is getting together to share best practices. We're also going to institute a training program for new MPO board members and house it at our preeminent academic institutions at Cutter and I Street. Requires by October of this year for DOT to review the boundary lines of our current 7 districts and see if it's time to redistrict them based on population growths. And then, most excitingly, we're going to replace the state license plate, the one with the orange that has a website at the top of it, if anyone's ever noticed that. And that, members, is the PCB.
Thank you very much, Representative McFarland. Seeing no amendments, members, are there questions on the bill? Seeing no questions, Representative Robinson, you are recognized.
Thank you, Chair. I just want to know about the license plate. We're going to take the orange off?
You're recognized.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So the way that we've written it in the bill is we're going to charge Highway Safety and Motor Vehicle to come up with a new design and replace the plate. I personally hope to have input on that design, but that we've had that license plate for, I believe, 30 years, and it's time to update it.
Any follow-up? Representative Lamarca, you're recognized.
Thank you, Chair. Representative Robinson piqued my interest. Will there be any mention of the United States Navy on this plate?
You're recognized.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And again, if I have my vote, perhaps.
Any follow-up? And members, any further questions on the bill? Seeing no questions, is there public testimony on the bill? Any member of the public wish to provide testimony? No. Members, we are now in debate on the bill. Any debate? Representative Cheney, you're recognized.
Thank you, Chair Andrade. Thank you, Rep. McFarland, for bringing this good bill forward. You know, there's a lot of money going into transit in the state of Florida, and our goal is to reduce congestion. Yet we're seeing across the state that transit is declining by 30 to 40%. Yet our transit authorities are increasing their spending by hiring more staff, purchasing more buses, taking lanes away from drivers. And this all comes out of the MPOs very often. There's a tremendous lack of accountability and transparency in our transit authorities. I've talked to my other members. They reflect the same concerns. My transit authority, the Pinellas County Transit Authority, PSTA, less than 2% of our population rides the bus. Six of the routes comprise 60% of the transit, and it's 94% taxpayer subsidized. Yet we have so many other needs, including transit throughout the county that's not being addressed. And my transit authority spent $700,000 on a study that told them to look at focusing on their core routes and supplementing with microtransit. Yet none of the transit authorities are doing this. They're in the buggy whip business. And it's time for change, and I am so happy to hear that your bill is bringing some measurable accountability to our transit. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Members, any further debate? Seeing no further debate, Representative McFarland, you're recognized to close.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And as I close my bill, I'd actually request a favor of all you members. Talk about this bill with your MPOs back home. Over the last year, I believe I've spoken to all of your MPOs. Not all of them. I've spoken to most of your MPOs, but maybe they've had some time to sit with this bill. Like, please bring me their feedback. I want to make this a good bill. Not everyone will love it. I can't promise you that. I actually promise you they won't all love it. But I'm willing to include any more good ideas that are out there into this bill. Thank you, members.
Thank you very much. Having closed, DJ, please call the vote.
Chair Andrade?
Yes.
Vice Chair Cheney?
Yes.
Ranking Member Silvers? Representatives Antone? Yes. Burfield?
Yes.
Brackett?
Yes.
Daly?
Yes.
Esposito?
Yes.
Gia Lombardo?
Yes.
Harris?
Yes.
Lamarca?
Yes.
Lopez?
Yes.
Placencia?
Yes.
Robinson?
Yes.
Yeager? Yes. 13 yeas, 0 nays.
Thank you very much. Show the bill reported favorably. Thanks, Representative. Next up, we have CS for HB 247 by Representative Maney. Representative Maney, you are recognized.
Thank you, Chairman, Vice Chair, members of the committee. House Bill 247 is a short, simple, citizen and business-oriented bill, reform bill. Very simply, the tax collectors want you to ease the way to transfer motor vehicles upon the death of a person who dies intestate without a will by changing the affidavit form to get that done. It helps military families who frequently move or onto a base or to another base. The post office, I was going to say postal service, but really it's more like the old post office department. They've changed their rules on forwarding mail, so titles are getting lost, registrations getting lost in the mail. This bill will waive the $75 fee if a title gets lost and they have to go back and get a duplicate. It provides that trailer owners will have the option of, for the same price, of getting a motorcycle size tag for their trailers so that you don't have a big tag. And then when we've all seen them, the tags get all bent, and it will address that problem. for people who are 100% disabled veterans. We just heard a question about the Navy. They no longer will have to get a disabled tag. They can get a Navy tag or a Marine tag or Air Force tag or an Army tag. And they do it for the same price. And it provides for, like we did last time, where we gave permanent registration to rental cars. This bill will allow permanent registration, still the annual fees, but permanent registration for trucks under 15,000 pounds. That's the bill, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you very much.
Thank you for scheduling this bill for a hearing. I do appreciate it.
Yes, sir. Thank you very much, Representative Maney. I do not see any amendments. Members, are there questions on the bill? Seeing no questions on the bill, we're in public testimony. First up is Tim Qualls, Florida Tax Collectors Association, waves in support. Next up is Leslie Doogie, Enterprise Mobility, waving in support. That is it for public testimony. Members, we are now in debate on the bill. Seeing no debate on the bill, Representative Maney, you are recognized to close.
Ways close with gratitude and hopes for that you'll support my bill. Thank you.
Thank you very much. DJ, please call the vote.
Chair Andrade?
Yes.
Vice Chair Cheney?
Yes.
Ranking Member Silvers?
Yes.
Representatives Antone?
Yes.
Burfield?
Yes.
Brackett?
Yes.
Daly?
Yes.
Esposito?
Yes.
Gialombardo?
Yes.
Harris?
Yes.
Lamarca?
Yes.
Lopez?
Yes.
Placencia?
Yes.
Robinson?
Yes.
Yeager? That is 14 yeas, 0 nays.
Thank you very much. Show the bill reported favorably. Thank you, Representative.
Thank you, Chairman. Thank you, Committee.
All right. Next up, we have CS for HB 287 by Representative Esposito. Representative, you are recognized to present the bill.
Thank you, Chair. Members, this bill provides clarifying language regarding AV technology, clarifies the RFP process for design-build contracts, and limits the liability for contractors when the performance of the work is deemed to be in compliance with contract documents. That is the bill.
Thank you very much. I see one amendment. Representative Esposito, you are recognized to present amendment barcode 274933.
Thank you, Chair. This amendment replaces some of the utility language to with language that has been agreed upon by all the stakeholders.
Thank you very much for that explanation. Members, are there questions on the amendment? Is there public testimony on the amendment? I don't believe so. Seeing no public testimony on the amendment, is there debate on the amendment? Seeing no debate on the amendment, show the amendment adopted without objection. We'll move back onto the bill as amended. Members, are there questions on the bill as amended? Seeing no questions on the bill as amended. Is there public testimony? Yes, there is. First up, Stefano Portigliatti, educator and attorney, wishes to speak on the bill.
Good morning, Mr. Chair. Thank you. Thank you, Representative Esposito, for your time so far through the life of the bill. I have 4 points I want to make, and I'm going to try to make them briefly. The first one is I understand the impetus of attempting to prevent unfair, unreasonable claims against contractors for incidents that happen out there on the roadway when some rogue subcontractor, there's something stupid. And we're all for it. Unfortunately, we believe, or I believe, I should speak for myself, that this goes a little farther than that, and I'd like to point that out, point out how. First, I think it's important to understand that protections already exist for that fear of the fraudulent claim. We have statute 337.195 that specifically states that contractors are immune from liability for death or injury if they're compliant with contract documents material to the condition. That is already the law. Secondly, design engineers are presumed to have prepared the plans appropriately with care. So there's already law in place that protects the contractors. Secondly, we have common law that has been developing for decades in the state. There's Supreme Court opinions that make it clear that the simple contract between the contractor and the sub doesn't mean that that liability goes up the chain. There has to be some involvement, some control, or some negligence on the part of the contractor. And then we have all the procedural steps that a case has to go through for it to materialize into a real claim. There's motions to dismiss, motions for judgment on the pleadings, motions for summary judgment. There's judges watching the process. And then there's a jury that's going to decide whether or not that's a fair, reasonable claim to be making against a contractor or not. So there's layers and layers upon layers of protection for contractors presently, which make the level of protection that this bill currently provides, I believe, unnecessary and counterproductive for the following reasons. I understand that a lot of the focus has been on the building, on the construction of roadways and bridges. But the language isn't limited to construction. It also includes maintenance. The bill specifically addresses when a contractor deviates from construction documents, which is defined in the bill as specifications for road and bridge construction. A lot of the work that goes on out there and a lot of the injuries that we see because of negligence on the part of the people involved don't have to do with construction, but with simple maintenance. I have a case right now where a road dilapidated to the point where there was a sinkhole and no one knew exactly how to address it, and they let it be. And it got worse and worse and worse, and someone drove over it, lost control, major crash. That was a maintenance issue, not a construction. And that brings me to my third point. Those contracts cannot possibly address every conceivable situation that a contractor or a subcontractor will encounter when they're out there doing complex work on the roadways. So to say that if they complied with the contract, they can't be liable for injury or death on the roadway doesn't quite cover all the bases, because there's going to be situations where they could very well be in compliance with the contract, but negligent in some regard that's not addressed by the contract, and they can point to the bill and say, I complied with the contract that wasn't covered by the contract. It does allow for liability for latent conditions, but then you're going to create a very narrow path where only if they deviate from a clear contract and it's a latent or an invisible or a hidden condition that they were responsible for creating. So I appreciate Representative Esposito's availability so far, and I hope that we can take these things into account as this moves ahead. The last point I'll make is it does have a little bit of a conflict with the workers' compensation laws. Right now, if a subcontractor does not carry, it lapses, or for some reason isn't covered under workers' compensation, it doesn't have that coverage available to its workers, the whole chain is treated as one, and that could go up to the contractor as a suit, a direct suit for the injury of the worker. As written, a contractor is not liable for injury or death. It doesn't say of third parties. It doesn't say of someone that's not an employee. So technically, I believe there could be a conflict between this bill and the existing workers' compensation laws that I hope can be addressed. Thank you very much. I feel like that was a little long, but I really appreciate you all listening and being here doing what you do. Have a good day.
Sorry. Thank you very much, Mr. Portigliotti. Next up, we have Anath Prasad on behalf of FTBA.
Good morning, Chair and members of the committee. Specifically want to touch on the limits of liability provision in the bill. It's a work in progress. We're going to continue to work on, but a couple of misconceptions of this bill we heard over the progress of this bill. This language does not extend sovereign immunity to contractors. The contractors are 100% liable if they did something on the contract that is not in compliance with the contract document. contract documents are very specific. We heard the example of sinkhole. I can tell you if the contractor didn't save up the sinkhole, he would not be in compliance with the contract documents. The department contract states that you cannot have a drop-off more than 3 inches next to a travel way, 3 inches. So a sinkhole presumably will have a much more greater drop-off than 3 inches, and the contractor would have to save up that. We're going to clean up. Obviously, we're working with the sponsor here to clean up some of the language. It talks about immune from liability, probably reverted back to that the contractor is not liable. We believe that that may be what the genesis of the sovereign immunity discussion is. And also add in the requirement that the contractor has to still manage his subs. This is not meant to for the big contractor to wash their hands and say, sub, you got to do. DOT holds the contractor responsible for all actions of the sub. But if the contractor is able to prove in a court that he did everything according to the contract, including telling the sub not to do something that would create an unsafe condition, and that sub decides on his own accord do something that creates that, we believe it should be the sub's responsibility, not the contractor. And that's basically what this bill addresses. So thank you.
Thank you very much, Mr. Prasad. Next up, we have Bob Nave of Florida Tax Watch. Sir, you are recognized.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, distinguished members. My name is Bob Nave. I'm a member of the research team at Florida Tax Watch. My comments today are going to be limited to the unsolicited proposal, public-private partnership proposal provisions in the bill. The American Society of Civil Engineers has estimated that the gap between the infrastructure we have today and the infrastructure that we're going to need in 10 years is going to cost more than $2.5 trillion. Now, the legislature has acknowledged that the public resources that are available to meet that demand are inadequate, and they have encouraged investment and risk sharing from the private sector. Now, the private sector does that through public-private partnerships, and there are two types of those. They're solicited and unsolicited. And these projects have shown to be able to deliver needed infrastructure upgrades faster and at a lower cost than currently planned. It also has other societal benefits like job creation and stuff like that. The question is, why are they not used more often, and what can we do to increase the use of public-private partnerships and public-public partnerships? And one of the problems and one of the reasons why we don't use these more is the slow pace of government procurement. Florida Tax Watch thinks the legislature should be looking for ways to fast-track unsolicited P3 proposals where a private entity is sharing in the risk and the cost, and that the project has been shown to be in the public's best interest. For these projects, Tax Watch supports the idea of a trade-off where these projects would be permitted to move forward with minor obstacles, but not at the expense of accountability, transparency, and taxpayer value. In January of last year, Florida Tax Watch released a report on public-private partnerships and public-public partnerships and what we can do to increase their use and make them more effective. And, Mr. Chairman, I'd like to leave a copy of this for the committee, if I can.
If you can just give it to the Sergeant-at-Arms in the back.
I'll leave it here.
Thank you.
One of the recommendations in that report is that the legislature eliminate the requirement that public entities, after they receive and review an unsolicited public-private partnership proposal, continue to solicit and accept proposals for that same project. Tax Watch thinks those projects should be permitted to go forward if three conditions have been met. One, the project and all the supporting documentation, which is many, have been reviewed by the public entity, by other affected public entities, and by the public at large. Second condition would be that the public entity makes a determination that this project will in fact implement the upgrade quicker, at a lower cost, and will have other benefits like job creation and stuff like that. And then third, that the public entity conducts a duly noticed public meeting at which their process and their findings are discussed, and they essentially issue what is a finding of public interest on the project. So when those conditions are met, we think these projects should be allowed to go forward. So I ask that the legislature consider our recommendations as this bill moves through the process. And with that, Mr. Chair, I thank you for letting me share my thoughts today.
Thank you very much, Mr. Knave. Last appearance card we have is Latoya Lodge on behalf of the Florida Justice Association.
Good morning. Good morning, Chair. Good morning, representatives. I'm Latoya Lodge. I'm an attorney in Fort Lauderdale in Broward County. And I firstly want to thank our sponsor on this bill. We appreciate the sponsor for working with us to clarify some of the issues and to address some of our concerns. I wanted, you know, to bring to the panel's attention three main concerns that we have with this bill. The firstly, with regard to general contractors and their immunity. In our view, the bill needs some language, some clarification that claims against contractors for their own negligence are preserved. So in other words, general and subcontractors should not be immunized for errors or omissions attributed to them or for their own failures to monitor, supervise, or exercise reasonable care. I appreciate one of the previous speakers identifying that they are willing to work with us as well to deal with the supervision issue. The second thing I'd like to bring before your attention is prior to this committee stop, there was a committee, I believe it was a Senate committee, where there was a particular case that was being misrepresented before the panels. That case, it was misrepresented as, you know, a rogue employee on a construction site that fails to follow the instruction of the general contractor. And at some point, the general contractor was the one who was hit with a big verdict. And I'd like to clarify that case because that case took place in my district, in my county, on May 25th, 2015. That case is the Asmat versus Ranger case. And in that case, the general contractor, Ranger, at about 11 o'clock at night or 10-something at night, summoned one of the subcontractors from the Miramar Parkway Bridge to the Pembroke Road median. He summoned the contractor for a last-minute pickup of 51,000 pounds of concrete barriers to be returned to the Miramar Parkway Bridge. He drove in his white F-150 pickup truck and instructed the subcontractor to follow him. The subcontractor did. They got to the median at Pembroke Road. When they did, he instructed him how to park the semi-trailer and loaded the 51,000 pounds of concrete barriers on the truck, bringing the total weight of the trailer to 80,000 pounds. He then, the contractor, made an illegal U-turn going now southbound on I-75 back to Miramar Parkway. The contractor that he summoned to and instructed to follow him did. When he did, he blocked all four lanes of southbound traffic on I-75. There were no flagmen, there were no FHP special escort, there were no lights, there were no reflective tape on the truck. And vehicles coming at highway speed, I-75 is an interstate superhighway, and four vehicles crashed into that into the semi, two persons died on the spot, the other two were catastrophically injured. That case went before a jury for 4 weeks. It was a 4-week trial. And after 4 weeks, the jury found that Ranger, the general contractor, was in fact liable because he was the employer as an agent in this situation for what that subcontractor did. His actions were so grossly negligent that the jury awarded $25 million in punitive damages. Punitive damages requires a higher standard. That there's a showing that the contractor was so grossly negligent and wanting in care. And so punitive damages is essentially to deter future conduct like that. So just for clarification, it wasn't a matter of a rogue contractor who or subcontractor who went off on his own way, and all of a sudden you have a liability that is attached to the contractor. The third thing I'd like to address is the lines 721 to 729. Currently, that portion of the bill seeks to delete the current language of Florida Statute 337-195 regarding an immune contractor's appearance on a verdict form. Under the current law, if a contractor is found to be immune from liability under its provisions, then the non-party immune contractor may not be added to the verdict form. With removing this from the law, the bill would seek to remove that provision, and then that would open the door for defendants to ask judges to add immune contractors and subcontractors to the verdict form, thereby diluting a jury award. So those are the three main concerns we have with this bill. We are happy to continuously work with the bill's sponsor and our previous speaker regarding supervision and matters of negligence where this is concerned. Thank you for your time.
Thank you. You may, and then I actually have a question to you. So you're recognized, Ms. Robinson.
Thank you, Chair. So I just want to have clarity on the case that you shared with us. If this was to be passed, how would that affect the outcome?
Okay. So currently there are protections. I believe a number of speakers spoke to the idea that there are protections in place for this general contractor. Now, this case went before a jury. The jury found that there was negligence on the part of the general contractor. What this bill proposes is that there will be no liability to that general contractor if, in fact, he was or she was acting in accordance with the contract documents. It doesn't speak to actions outside of the contract document that could constitute negligence. So we have two separate things happening here. We have a contractual duty and we have statutory duty under our statutory law, negligence, duty, breach, causation, damages, right? So there's two different things that were happening here. So if it is that the bill says you will be immune from liability if you are in compliance with the contract documents, but here you are in compliance with the contract documents and still engaging in actions that are negligent, causing injury, then you're not liable on this end.
One follow-up.
You're recognized.
So, and I'm not an attorney. So what you're saying is, so because if that particular general contractor was following the contract, it would have never been even to go to court?
Right. Or? So if under this law, if it is that he says we were following the contract, we went to pick up, you know, the barriers, we did that and that in accordance with the language and specificity of the contract, but his actions of making a U-turn improperly in the street and instructing the subcontractor to do the same and not having, you know, all of those things that the jury found constituted negligence, he would not have been held liable because his defense was we were under the contract and we were in compliance with the contract, making no accountability for his negligence and gross negligence because the jury found $25 million worth of punitive damages for his gross negligence.
Thank you. Ms. Lodge, did the jury find that he was in compliance with the safety plan portion of his contract?
Actually, he did not. So there were two issues that happened here. One, the MOT was delinquent. The gentleman who was on the site was also the superintendent of the construction site, and he was the MOT supervisor. There are a few things, and if I can quote from it directly. He did not order lane closures. He interrupted the flow of traffic, which one of the contract requirements is not being, you know, not interrupting the flow of traffic. There were no lighting and cones and signage, no flagmen. There were no lane closures and no FHP special escort. So there were a number of things that, in this case, he both violated the contract and, on the other hand, negligent in the way he conducted.
So just to summarize, he wasn't in compliance with the contract, and if this bill passes, he couldn't use that as a defense.
I don't believe I understand what you're asking me, and if I can clarify. In this particular case, there were two sets of violations. One violation was not being in compliance with the contract. Another violation was just breach of his duty of care, which is the highest duty of care when you're dealing with construction projects. Had he been still, let's say he was in compliance with the document, there's still a finding on this end that he was it violated his duty of care.
Do you have a single case where a contractor's complied with the safety plan in their MOT and were still the proximate cause of damage?
I do not have that in front of me, but if I am able to, I'll find one and provide it to you if that's okay.
Thank you very much.
I appreciate you. Thank you. Thank you again, Bill Sponsor.
Seeing no further public testimony, members, we are in debate. Representative Harris, you are recognized.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Esposito, I saw this bill in the previous committee, and there was just a lot of confusion. And I even asked the question if the subcontractor was following the contract and something happened, who would be responsible? And there wasn't an answer that was clear. And so I feel at this point, this is very, for lack of a better word, messy. It's going to create a lot of messiness in the courts. And so for that reason, I will be voting down on this bill. Thank you.
Very much. Representative Robinson, you are recognized.
Thank you, Chair. And thank you, Representative Esposito. And I recognize that this is a transportation package, and want to be able to vote up for it, but I do have very serious concerns because overall, we're here to look out for Floridians, the everyday people that are in our state. And this seems as if it's limiting their ability when they're in a situation. One of the questions I didn't get my hand up to ask, or maybe you can tell us in a closing, you mentioned something about a safety plan. I guess I want to know, is there a unified safety plan for the contractor and the subcontractor, something that all of them have to follow? You know, because it appears that we're limiting Floridians to be able to access the court system, but we're not really holding the contractors or the business, you know, to the full accountability. And that causes me problems because I know in other pieces of legislation, it's like we keep on limiting what the everyday person can do and giving more rights to corporate and businesses. And that's not what I want to do. So at this time, I'm not going to be able to support this, but I hope that we can, you know, do something about it to even the playing field for everybody.
Thank you very much. Any further debate? Just to summarize a few things, yes, the Florida Department of Transportation sets these contract terms. They place contract clauses and requirements by rule that have to be established within every contract they have, and also put on requirements, general contractors, what they have to have between themselves and subcontractors. Safety plans are part of every single DOT contract, and if a contractor or subcontractor is not compliant with those safety plans, they're not in compliance with their contract. They cannot use compliance with the contract as a defense if they're the proximate cause of harm. A lot of times it's very easy to misconstrue cases when we get here because cases often take several years. There's lots of context. But you just heard this one description of a case where this provision in this bill wouldn't apply because the contractor didn't comply with the contract terms or safety terms. They could not use it as a defense. While it's easy to misconstrue and overcomplicate, this is a very simple proposal. If you comply with the safety provisions, which are part of every contract DOT requires of private companies, you comply with those safety plans and every other requirement, every other standard that's passed down by the state or federal law, you can enjoy a peace of mind that because you complied with those and you did everything that we've established is in the best interest of citizens, you shouldn't run the risk of being, you know, brought into a case where you weren't the proximate cause of harm. I understand their concerns. However, I just want to make that clarification before I recognize Representative Esposito to close.
Thank you, Chair.
Andrade?
Yes.
Vice Chair Cheney?
Yes.
Ranking Member Silvers?
No.
Representatives Antone?
No.
Burfield?
Yes.
Brackett?
Yes.
Daly?
No.
Esposito?
Yes.
Gia Lombardo?
Yes.
Harris?
No.
Lamarca?
Yes.
Lopez?
Yes.
Plasencia?
Yes.
Robinson?
No.
Yeager? That is 9 yeas, 5 nays.
Show the bill reported favorably. Congratulations, Representative Esposito. Next up, we have House Bill 841 by Representative Rayner.
Good morning. Thank you so much, Mr. Chair, Vice Chair, and Ranking Member. This is HB 841, and once again, I want to thank Chair Andrade for making sure that this got agenda today. I am honored and proud to present HB 841. It looks like some of you have heard this in its first stop. This bill is to designate portions of the Gandy Bridge for Airman Mohammed Mo Haytham. Many of you may not know this, but in 2019, Airman Mohammed Haytham was attending flight school at the Pensacola Naval Air Station. And he was less than a month from graduating and had a dream to serve his country. And sadly, that dream was taken far too early. Mo, as his family calls him, was killed in the Naval Air Station shooting on December 6th, 2019, a few days from his 20th birthday. And what happened on that day is that Mohammed, he ran towards danger. He had the option to flee. He was unarmed. He decided to confront the gunman to make sure that no other people were harmed. His actions that day saved numerous lives. And with his dying breath, he was able to tell law enforcement where the killer was in order to ensure that no other harm would come to anyone else. While Mohammed was born in Louisiana, he was also from St. Petersburg. He went to Lakewood High School, which is in my district. And this bill would designate parts of Gandy Bridge with his name. At the last committee stop, his mother was here and testified beautifully. And there is an amendment.
Thank you very much, Representative Rayner. You are recognized to present amendment barcode 107363.
Thank you so much, Mr. Chair. And this amendment simply comes from his mother. We would remove the word airman and replace it with AWF3 and would remove Muhammad's middle name, Sammy, and just it would be AWF3 Mohammed Mo Haytham Memorial Highway. And that is the amendment.
Thank you very much. Members, are there any questions on the amendment? Seeing no questions on the amendment. I don't believe that there's any public testimony. Is there a debate on the amendment? Seeing no debate, show that amendment adopted without objection. Representative Rayner, you're recognized to close on the amendment.
Wave close.
Oh, wait. Sorry? Yeah. Sorry, I got a little ahead of myself. Show that amendment adopted without objection. Are there questions on the bill as amended? Seeing no questions on the bill as amended, is there public testimony? Seeing no public testimony, is there debate on the bill as amended? Representative Rayner, I just want to say thank you again for bringing this bill. Myself, Senator Broxson, and his legislative aide, Janice Gilley, was the county administrator at the time on December 6th in 2019. It will forever be the worst day I'll have in public office. There were three young men who died, and this was the last terrorist attack on a U.S. military base. This is the most recent one we've had. We had Ensign Joshua Watson run out of the building and alert our sheriff's deputies about what was going on inside. Those sheriff's deputies ran up. Several of them were shot in the process. They encountered Airman Haytham and Airman Haytham. And Cameron Walters both did everything they could to help their brothers in arms. And It meant a lot to me to see this last week, and I appreciate you bringing it. And I cannot be more excited to see him being recognized in his hometown. Thank you. You're recognized to close.
Thank you so much, Mr. Chair. And thank you again for making sure that this bill was agended. Members, I ask for your favorable support, and not just because it's my bill, but because Evan Lynn Brady, who's is Airman's Haytham's mother, was here, and this was her only child. And her only child displayed exceptional heroism and bravery in the face of incredible evil. And with that, I ask for your favorable support.
Thank you very much, DJ. Please call the roll.
Chair Andrade?
Yes.
Vice Chair Cheney?
Yes.
Ranking Member Silvers?
Yes.
Representatives Antone?
Yes.
Burfield?
Yes.
Brackett?
Yes.
Daly?
Yes.
Esposito?
Yes.
Gio Lombardo?
Yes.
Harris?
Yes.
Lamarca?
Yes.
Lopez?
Yes.
Plasencia?
Yes.
Robinson?
Yes.
Yeager? That is 14 yeas, 0 nays.
Thank you very much. Show that bill reported favorably. Thank you, Representative. Our final bill on the docket today is CS for HB 39 by Representative Koster. Representative Koster, you are recognized.
Thank you, Chair. See, you saved the best for last. First, I have to apologize because Chair Robinson put up a hefty agenda in civil justice, and I completely slipped my mind to reach out to all of you on this bill. And so, to the extent you have questions or concerns, I really am truly apologize for not having reached out sooner. It's not my habit. But thank you, Chair, Vice Chair, committee members. Despite Florida law requiring an automatic year-long suspension of a license for first-time offenders who refuse to take a breathalyzer, statistics show an alarmingly large percentage of drivers here in Florida who continue to drive on a suspended license. With the introduction of interlock devices, these small handheld breathalyzers prevent users from starting their car after drinking. In the last 3 years, interlock devices prevented over 30,000 drunk driving attempts in Florida alone. HB 39 updates current law to close a loophole, allowing suspended license holders from being able to drive while intoxicated. The bill requires interlock devices to be used through the administrative license suspension process when someone refuses to submit to a breathalyzer. That is the bill.
Thank you very much. Seeing no amendments, members, are there questions on the bill? Representative Harris, you're recognized.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you, Representative. First and foremost, I am very much against drunk driving, and so I appreciate the intent to keep our roads as safe as possible. I heard the bill in the last committee, and I voted up. I had a little bit more time with the bill, and so one of the questions I have is, it says refusal to submit breath, urine, and blood tests. How would that be administered at a stop, like a urine and blood test?
You're recognized.
Thank you, Chair. So not in law enforcement. We do have I do have somebody here that can probably speak to the exact logistics of how that goes on. My understanding is the breathalyzer would be done right at the accident scene. If you were refusing a breath test, maybe Representative Daly's shaking his head, so he might have some insight on this as well. I do divorce. I try not to dabble in criminal law, but honestly, I don't know the answer. So,
thank you.
Any follow up? No. Representative Plasencia, you're recognized.
And then. Thank you, and thank you for previous conversations that we've had regarding this bill. I have a question regarding the interlocking devices themselves. Are they currently being used? Whether administratively or in, you know, once you're in the criminal justice system for drinking and driving, how are they currently being used?
You're recognized.
Thank you, Chair. Yes, they are currently being ordered by the court in the criminal process and through the criminal court system. They are not currently being used just through the administrative process.
You follow? No. Representative Robinson, you're recognized, and then Representative Daly.
Chair, and my question has to do with the interlock device also. So we're now saying that if they refuse, they have to have this device. Who's going to pay for it?
You recognize?
Thank you, Chair. They would pay for it.
Yeah.
Follow up?
I mean, I guess And it's not a question, so I'll save it for later. Because I'm trying to figure out that we haven't proven them guilty, but then we're going to affect their monthly budget. So I just don't understand.
I hear a question on the constitutionality and due process of the aspect. Representative Koster, you're recognized to answer if you'd like.
Thank you, Chair. So as I said in the last committee stop, driving is a privilege, not a right. And on your driver's license, it says that there are consequences for not submitting to a breathalyzer. The reason for that is that we've decided as a state, you know, that, again, driving is a privilege. And if you are going to drive intoxicated and you're not going to submit to a breathalyzer test, there's going to be consequences. Right now, those consequences are you get a suspended license. We are now adding to those consequences the interlock device because we're seeing that there are still folks driving with a license suspended, getting second DUIs. So we're trying to close that loophole.
Any follow-up? No?
It seems as if when you start the suspending license, good with that. But when you start affecting someone's pay, you know, their budget, how they do their household, we're forcing them to pay for something. It kind of seems like I don't know if that's civil rights. We're going a little bit too far. If we were going to pay for it, then, you know, okay, you have to have it. But now we're forcing them to pay for something, and we haven't even proven that they're wrong.
I can't quite summarize that debate.
I think I can potentially address a question. So they still have the right to contest the suspension, to contest the entire process. They can request an administrative hearing, and if there's enough there to eliminate the ticket altogether, then they wouldn't get the device. But, you know, when we're up here passing laws, we're constantly faced with balancing policy. And here the policy decision is saving lives from drunk drivers and charging someone what I understand the average to be about $3 a day for this device. I am sensitive to the fact that folks live paycheck to paycheck. I understand that. I am sensitive to that. But if you've been touched by somebody who's been hurt or killed by a drunk driver, that $3 a day, you know, feels less significant. And I also have to push back and say, you know, if they can afford to be intoxicated, then they can afford to pay $3 a day for a device. I mean, and alcohol is not free either. We don't pay for people to get drunk. The government doesn't support that. So I understand the policy concerns. I do. And I understand that folks live paycheck to paycheck.
Thank you very much, Rep. Koster. Representative Daly, you were recognized. For debate? You sure? All right. Any further questions? Oh, Representative Placencia, you were recognized. For a second bite of the apple.
Thank you. Actually, it was it sparked another question for me. So the interlock devices are currently used within the criminal justice system. So if I'm assuming there's probable cause that you've been drinking and driving, then whatever, it goes through that system. When you're in that system, is there a way to help people to offset the cost of those devices? And if so, is that also considered when we're using this administratively?
You're recognized.
Thank you, Chair. I don't believe that they're currently through. I mean, so in the court system, there are ways to waive fines and fees if you're indigent. I don't believe that that applies to the interlock device specifically. Perhaps in your debate, Representative Daly, you might be able to address that for us. But, and there's not something specific in this bill to apply to setting off. A set off of the cost in the administrative process. But what I do know from a lot of the stakeholders that I've been talking to and working with, there are numerous nonprofits in the state who have said, we will step up and help allay some of the cost to keep these folks off the road or to keep the streets safer and to have these devices. So there's not something specific in the bill. I'm certainly happy to talk to folks. I have been offering to talk to folks about ideas of ways that we can try to come up with some cost assistance, but so far nobody's brought me a specific idea. And my door is always open, phone's always on. But I know there are lots of nonprofits that are happy to help with the cost.
Members, any further questions? Seeing no further questions, we're now in public testimony. First up is Amy Jameson on behalf of MAD. You're recognized.
Good morning, Chair and committee members. I come before you this morning with the hope of trying to help stop another person from being killed or injured by an impaired driver. Almost 26 years ago, my 16-year-old son was killed by a multiple DUI offender on his way home from work. Since that fatal day, I have had to learn a lot about impaired drivers, the laws, and why this had to happen to my son and so many other innocent victims. Starting a chapter of MAD in my community after losing my son and being very involved in the past almost 26 years, I have learned a lot. One of MAD's mission is to speak to DUI offenders at court-ordered victim impact panels. I have seen more than enough of my shares of DUI offenders. These thousands upon thousands of people that I have shared my story with that have had the privilege of having a driver's license and also many with driving impaired on a suspended license chose not to abide by the law and drove impaired. Once they decided to choose not to obey the law, in my opinion, they also chose to agree to all the consequences allowable by law. Unfortunately, the current fines and court-ordered sanctions don't deter people from abiding by the law, and many choose to break the law hoping not to get caught or don't care and choose to do it again. They either have no regard for fellow man and its laws or have a serious problem. With my 25 years experience dealing with the law enforcement, DUI offenders, fighting for laws here in this capital to protect the innocent, this one single piece of equipment holds a huge, huge key to protecting the innocent more than anything currently available to all the judges. The ignition interlock system changes behaviors and habits to keep the offender and the law-abiding citizen much safer. Driving is a privilege that affords every adult to be able to maintain our daily lives for groceries, work, doctors, kids, school activities, and the list goes on. Many offenders will continue this long list on a suspended driver's license, thinking it's either their right to get behind the wheel of a vehicle or have no other choice but to drive on a suspended license. This device helps offenders stay legal and still provide for many needs of an individual family, still maintaining the privilege of a valid driver's license. When was the last time you looked at the bottom of your driver's license? Do you remember what you agreed to when you signed your signature to that document? Do you remember agreeing to any test that law enforcement requested? If you don't care about each other's safety, then why are we creating more laws and statute? Let's just do a free-for-all and the survival of the fittest wins. But I believe you do care, or you wouldn't be here trying to make a difference. But then we also have to worry about those rights. I'm sorry. But then we also have to worry about whose rights are being infringed upon, as the opposition says. But it's okay for one of them to say it infringes on my rights to kill my child or anyone else's loved one. You have not had to live with that person's choice, what it does to a family and each person's individually. What about my rights? When you go home to your family tonight, look at them as it could be the last time you see them, because they are out there 24 hours a day, 7 days a week. The drunk driver that killed my son not only killed him, but the family unit. Sorry. And the emotional destruction that it caused my other child, lasting over 17 years. Still to this day, the effects from that one choice still linger. But I am a survivor. I will fight for my son, who had to pay with his life, and for my other son, who was still here. Also for the many innocent victims that can't be here to plead their cases and no longer have a voice to plead, and all those who will be a victim in the future. You hold the key to life and death. Each of you sitting on this committee hold that key. Will you choose life or give the death sentence to many innocent citizens? Thank you for your time and service.
Thank you, very much, Ms. Jameson. Next up, we have Kristen Allen on behalf of Mothers Against Drunk Driving.
Good morning, Mr. Chair, committee members. Thank you for this opportunity to speak. My name is Kristen Allen. I'm the affiliate executive director for MAD North Florida. Drunk driving remains a problem in Florida. I wish I could stand up here and say we solved it, but we haven't. In 2022, 1,115 people were killed in impaired driving crashes. Those are mothers, fathers, sisters, brothers, friends, coworkers, tourists, who are no longer here to a 100% preventable crime. As you may know, 35% of the 43,000 people in Florida who were arrested for DUI in 2021 refused a test, exceeding the national refusal rate of 20%. Currently, drunk drivers who refuse a test can obtain a restricted license, allowing them to drive without an ignition or lock. House Bill 39 would provide much-needed public safeguards to ensure safe and sober driving. Ignition airlocks are already working in Florida. From 2006 to 2020, these devices stopped over 131,000 attempts to drive impaired at a 0.08. I call it a behavior modification tool. That's what that device is. It's a behavior modification tool. Enacting House Bill 39 will take advantage of this effective countermeasure and prevent countless deaths and injuries by keeping even more drunk drivers off our road. Help make Florida's roads safer. Let's not put a price tag on human life. Personal responsibility does matter. On behalf of the nearly 1 million drunk driving victims MAD has served, please support House Bill 39. Thank you for your time.
Thank you very much, Ms. Allen. Next, we have Frank Stevens, who waves in support. Barney Bishop, on behalf of Florida Smart Justice Alliance, waves in support. Nancy Stewart, Florida Association of DUI Programs, waves in support. William Smith, Florida PBA, waves in support. Aaron Waite, Florida Association of Criminal Defense Lawyers, waves in opposition. That concludes public testimony. Members, we are now in debate. Representative Daly, you're recognized.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you, Representative Koster, for this good bill. I supported it last year in this committee, and that was before I became a prosecutor and got a really, really close up view of this and DUI cases and how this all works currently. And so I did want to address a couple of the comments that were made. Before I do so, you know, you mentioned it, and funny enough, I mention it in every jury trial. I mention it to the jurors every single time, and the look of surprise on their face when I ask them to pull out their license and look at the bottom. I try to pick somebody that's either wearing glasses or is a little bit younger in the jury pool so they can see it, and I don't embarrass them in front of everybody. But operation of a motor vehicle constitutes consent to any sobriety test required by law. And there's an existing process in place. This is not, hey, you get pulled over, the cop, you know, the officer walks up to the window and says, hey, I'd like you to use, you know, to perform a breath test. It's much more nuance than that, right? The officer has to have reasonable suspicion to even ask. There has to be signs of impairment. There has to be reasonable suspicion developed in the officer's mind, and that only gets you to asking to perform field sobriety exercises. So you can't even, you need even more. It's a higher burden to ask for breath. So reasonable suspicion gets you to field sobriety exercises. If they don't perform field sobriety exercises or perform poorly on field sobriety exercises, then and only then would you get to the question of, is probable cause developed? And if probable cause is developed, then and only then can somebody say, I'd like a breath test. And to answer Rep. Harris's question, it's not usual to be given a breath test roadside, only because they use the intoxilizer. It's a very heavy piece of equipment. There's a whole process that goes into that. There's a 20-minute waiting period. It's not really practical. There are a couple of units that roam around and like a police SUV that'll bring it to the scene. But usually that individual, if they agree to give a breath test, are taken to a facility and there are facility operators. And there's a whole separate process that we don't need to go into, I don't think, today. you know, I'm comfortable and I'm more supportive of this bill today than I even was last year. And although my good colleague, Representative Gottlieb, who's a criminal defense attorney, may disagree with me, I think there are adequate safeguards. And to the speaker's point that came up, the number of people that I have seen and repeat offenders who I have seen who had their license suspended because they refused to blow, right, which is our current law, and applied and got a hardship license, right, which I understand there should be a process, but I do think it's a little easy. I think it's a little easy to get that hardship license and use it and candidly, in some cases, abuse it. And this is just one more step that may prevent people from doing something like that and from driving when they shouldn't be. So happy to support it and happy to continue working with you, and I'll be up today.
Representative Robinson, do you have debate?
Well, thank you, and I thank my colleague for giving the debate, because so for me, the challenge was, and I've had it on both sides. I had an uncle that was killed by a drunk driver, but then I also have a brother that, whether we want to admit it or not, profiling is real. And so it always concerned me, because I remember the times when my mom, when he was driving a car as a teenager, and she was like, let me know when you get there and let me know when you get back, because always fearful that he was going to be pulled over and things wasn't going to go in the right way. We always wanted to, but it doesn't. And so that was my challenge. But with Rep. Daly explaining that supposedly there's a long process before they get there, because a lot of times we already know that everybody's not right. That should be right. But so it was very challenging on determining where we go. And then the other concern that I had is, you know, now we're getting into their budget. But I'm going to pray over it over here by the time they get my name, and I don't know what I'm going to do. Thank you.
All right. Well, Representative Robinson is praying. Representative Placencia, you are recognized.
Thank you, Chair. Representative Koster, I know that we might not have had a chance to speak this year, but we did speak last year, and I support you in your efforts to make the streets safer. I really do. And because of that, I was a little conflicted about my no vote last year. And so when I went home, I had more conversations with my local law enforcement officers. And they told me a lot of what Representative Daly just mentioned. And what they did say, which is also what Daly mentioned, is that at some point there's probable cause. And when there's probable cause, that's when they ask you to use the breathalyzer. But if there's probable cause, then that means you will also be arrested, in which case you enter the justice system, and then that's when these devices can then be used at the discretion of the courts, and then possibly have fees waived or have assistance with those payments. I'm going to be down on the bill, but I do support your efforts, and I want to find a way to work with you if we can continue to have these conversations. I think what you're doing is important. I'm just not there.
Thank you very much, Representative Burfield. You're recognized in debate.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. And I think the most important thing that you said, Representative, when you were presenting, is it's a privilege. It's not a right. And to me, in my mind, a privilege is like a want. It's something we want in comparison to something we need. In this situation, it's a little bit unique, because there are situations where people need the ability to drive. And I think what this bill is attempting to do is to ensure that that privilege that some may not take as seriously as others do because of the impact that they can have. I think this gives a way for those who have a need to use that privilege to actually continue doing it while protecting those who value the privilege that they have been given. So I will be in support of the bill. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Is there any further debate? Seeing no further debate, while Representative Robinson is presumably still praying, Representative Koster, you're recognized to close.
Thank you, Chair, and I don't know whether I will convince you or not. Either way, that is the beauty of this process, right? You as well, Rep. Placencia, thank you for going home and for researching it and talking to folks. I mean, that really is what this process is all about. This bill didn't get through all the way last session, and maybe there's a reason why, and we're back here trying to make it better and keep fighting the good fight. So thank you all for the discussion today. We are, in Florida, one of the top four highest refusal rates in the country. I am not naive enough to think that this bill ends drunk driving. I wish it would. But it does close the loophole. We, in this day and age, we have Lyft, we have Uber. There's no excuse to get behind the wheel of a car after you have been drinking. And, you know, we are not trying to prevent people from driving. I agree with you, Rep. Burfield. It is a privilege, but it is also a need. I need my car. I wouldn't be able to pick my kids up from school. I wouldn't be able to get to work. I wouldn't be able to drive 4 hours to and from Tallahassee to do this job. So it is a privilege, but it's also a need. And I am not trying to stop people from driving. And I don't want people to have to choose between driving and eating. I understand all of that. But what I'm trying to do today is close a loophole from people driving drunk. And with that, I ask for your support.
Thank you very much, DJ. Please call the vote.
Chair Andrade?
Yes.
Vice Chair Cheney?
Yes.
Ranking Member Silvers?
Yes.
Representatives Antone?
Yes.
Burfield?
Yes.
Brackett? Daly?
Yes.
Esposito?
Yes.
Gia Lombardo?
Yes.
Harris?
Yes.
Lamarca?
Yes.
Lopez?
Yes.
Plasencia?
No.
Robinson?
Yes.
That'll be 13 yeas, one nay.
Show the bill reported favorably. Congratulations, Representative Koster.
Thank you, Chair. Thank you, committee.
Members, this concludes our committee agenda for the day. Seeing no further business before the committee, Representative Robinson prayerfully moves. We rise. All right.